Hello, I'm Lottie, and welcome to the Rogue Monkey podcast.
Welcome to the 99th episode of the Rogue Monkey podcast. My name is Kevin, and I host a show that brings you a regular dose of inspiration and motivation from guests who share their insights from their journeys to help you on yours. Today we speak to Lottie Unwin, founder at Upworld and Brand Hackers. I met Lottie at a conference last year on the west coast of Wales, and the community she has built, Upworld, is somewhere I have no doubt creative marketers from around the world will be drawn. It's a place for curious and ambitious minds, and certainly somewhere I would place myself. One line that stands out from our conversation today is this: fundamentally, if we are doing three things badly, stop and do one thing well. It sounds obvious, but how many businesses, whether they're small or large, are spread too thin on their strategies and end up achieving none of their objectives? Whether you've got a side hustle, you're looking to market yourself and grow, or you're an established business and you're looking for some fresh insights, our conversation today will hopefully give you something to take away and utilize. Lottie is hugely passionate about what she does, so be sure to connect with her straight after the episode to keep up with all the amazing things that she's doing in the marketing space. Make sure you hit subscribe however you're joining us today, and please drop us a comment after you've listened to our interview, as we would love to know what you thought. So here we go with episode 99 of the Rogue Monkey podcast and our conversation with founder and marketing legend, Lottie Unwin. Hi, Lottie, and welcome to the podcast. How are we doing?
Really good, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's taken us a little while to string together, but based how turbulent 2023 was, and we were just talking about how 2024 is a renewed sense of optimism, I'm glad we're doing it now and looking forward to a positive year ahead.
Maybe fate played a card in making us fail to meet diaries for 6 months so that now we can, start the new year on a good foot.
Well, obviously, we've got a lot of people I know in your community that engage in all the different things you do. But for any of our listeners and viewers that have not come across you before, can you just give us, I guess, a little bit of an intro and a bit of context to what your world looks like?
For sure. So I am obsessive about marketing. I think it's ultimately the most fascinating commercial art. And I love doing that with small businesses because I think that budget constraints and the pressure to think entrepreneurially is really interesting. So I run two businesses that kind of sit under this umbrella of all things startup marketing. One is called Upworld, which is a community for people in marketing. So you're the only person in your business, you're reporting into a founder, you need a support network for practical advice, you need someone to have a laugh with, you need somewhere to go to say that you've had a hard day. There's a community called Up Club that you can become a member of. We also do lots of recruitment, so helping amazing talent find kind of jobs that they never knew existed. So those jobs that you see and you're like, that's not what I thought my next step was going to be, but I'm so fired up by that. So that's Upworld. And then I run another business called Brand Hackers, where we run fractional marketing teams for brands with big dreams. So we work with founders, and there's 11 full-time in that business, and we work full-time with founders in growing their businesses, just doing their marketing work for them. So that's kind of me like a professional nutshell. And then personally, I'm a diehard CrossFitter and very passionate about mental health, and very passionate about the power of LinkedIn. I guess those are like my three, put me on a soapbox and I'll talk about mental health, CrossFit or LinkedIn.
Well, the metaphorical soapbox has arrived. So we're gonna pull on a few of those threads. And I think the thing I'm curious about is my day job, I work with a lot of professional athletes and I track their journeys back. Where did it all start? And actually, it's often seeded long before they first ever take a paycheck or work in the professional role with a title. So where did this kind of passion emerge from for all things marketing, but working, I guess, with founders and all those sorts of things? Where did that kind of seed first get sown?
It's such a good question. I think there's a few moments. So when I was really little, I think a great question for this is what did you used to do to play as a child? I think so much of our stories are rooted in how we played. And I've stolen that from the School of Life. I was asked it on a course and I just obsess over it as a question. And my play was that I would build worlds. So if the homework task was to make a poster for a school, I remember this vividly. I don't know why I was making a poster for a school. I made the poster, but I wrote the curriculum and I made the floor plan for the school and I wrote the textbooks and I kind of came in on Monday with like the full paperwork to launch a school. And it was this, it was just a real joy in curation. And I was a very sociable child and quite demanding, but incredibly happy on my own when I was deep in these projects. And I think that desire to make stuff has been a very clear theme for me. So I've always talked about running my own business long before I knew what that was. And then the marketing bit was a kind of later stage realization. So I thought I wanted to be a journalist, did lots of student journalism, realized that I was actually not a particularly good journalist. Like my grammar and sentence construction is lacking, to say the least. And was not good at that, but was really good at running a team. So I got kind of worked my way up in a student newspaper. So I was editing sections and then was editing the paper as a whole. And I had a real skill at getting 250 volunteers to produce content, so articles and photographs and illustrations and stuff, in a particular tone. And I kind of realized that was leadership and it was branding, because I was building a brand by communicating a vision and a message to them. So that was like a little thread. And then I just fell into, you know, that was the thread that made me think I'll apply for some marketing grad schemes. I applied for loads of management consultant stuff and got rejected from all of them. So I kind of found myself in marketing because I was rejected by management consultancy. But I just fell on my feet. It just so quickly felt like the thing I've always wanted to do.
Well, something I wanted to ask you about is hurdles. And I think a lot of people we've had on the show talk about adversity in whatever form it's hit them. And you kind of brushed over it a little bit there, but actually the fact that you had a whole process of going through applying for consultancy after consultancy after consultancy and just getting turned away. Let's talk through that a little bit, because that builds in its own way resilience, but it also gets you comfortable with the concept of applying for something with no guarantee that you're going to get a result at the end of it.
We can. I have had incredibly little adversity in my life. So I want to caveat this by saying I grew up in like a very privileged, not like silly privilege, but like I was incredibly comfortable. I went to private school. I went to Cambridge, but I was like groomed for Cambridge. I was groomed for Oxbridge applicants from when I was like 10. I honestly think I was like on a spreadsheet as kids who are going to make, you know, who are going to hit our Oxbridge quota from when I was like 8 to 10. So, you know, literally no surprises that I got that place. I got some resilience for sure from that whole process. So one, going to a university where everyone else was actually way smarter than you because they'd got their place from merit and I'd got my place by being taught how to think for an Oxbridge interview from when I was a child. So that was a great learning curve. And then, yeah, for sure, like I had my first experiences of failing at that time and it definitely built resilience. I feel like I owe it to the world to be very grateful for what I do have and not commiserate like my quite minor adversities. Like, I don't think anyone has an easy life, but I've been given an amazing platform.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the tools, if you like, that gave you through those early years takes you up to, you know, university and you know, postgraduate applications and all those sorts of things. How much of those early years contributed to the skill set that allow you to do what you do now? Because actually the day-to-day operations of running a business, you know, actually I feel it's almost like that the finish line almost feels like the start line, as in you get told, well, you've got to do this, you've got to do this, you've got to do this. You get there and they go, oh, by the way, now we've done our bit, over to you. And you go, what now?
Oh, yeah.
And suddenly, how's that played out?
My dad works in film and TV, like TV, film and theatre, and walks to the bottom of the garden every day where he has a shed, like a kind of home office thing, but it is a shed with a heater at his feet where he writes. And he has done that every day, mostly 7 days a week for my whole life. And he gets something made every few years. like literally rejection after rejection after rejection. And yet he takes his coffee to the shed every day. And that, like that, that's where I learned my resilience from watching that and seeing that that's what it takes to build things. And he's a very, like, he's been very clear with me that kind of value creation comes from ownership and is a real believer in the importance of owning ideas, which I think has really fueled my desire to do my own thing, but also like my ability to keep going. And absolutely, like what you've just described, a sense of there being no roadmap other than your own. Like I've been very, I had very good role models growing up for the idea that you kind of carve your own destiny.
So let's talk a little bit, I guess, then you're obviously then carving things for other people now in terms of opportunities and guidance and all those sorts of things. So, you know, you mentioned again around the kind of student newspaper aspect of learning to support a team and bring people together and those sorts of things. But what skills have you picked up along the way that allow you to flourish in the space that you're in now? Because actually that skill set, especially in managing two businesses, it's not like you're trying to do this in one single thing. Having your mind kind of split two ways and having you know, obviously a huge community that you're supporting, what kind of skills have you picked up so far that you can kind of communicate to go, that was really useful, that's kind of helped me here a lot?
I really believe that my ability to build relationships has been central to everything I've done. So I can make someone feel quite at ease with me, and I can understand their position, and I can get a feeling of rapport fast. And that's literally because I had to stand at stage doors when I was 7 and talk to like an actor who'd done some terrible play, and mum and dad would be like, "That's absolutely wonderful, you were amazing." And I would watch them put someone at ease and have those dynamics. And I was put into very adult situations very young. So I feel like I was holding my own with grown-ups from a very early age. And that's what Cambridge does. That absolutely sharpens that skill, because you're basically thrown into a seminar with a global expert on something, which, you know, excuse my language, fuck all about. You've got an hour with them, they're going to grill you, and you've got to not look like a fool. And that's, if you've done as little reading as I had done, that's an exercise in blagging it and in holding your own and holding your sense of self in that meeting. So I think relationship building is absolutely central and has been really important, and is how I have built the amazing team I've got, the level, like the quality of the people that work for me. Now my revenue kind of justifies it, and we can pay them properly, and I'm like, yeah, we're good enough for you to work with us. 2 years ago, that was true. You know, people, like, I was really pulling in favors. You know, people were kind of giving their whole weekday life to my business, kind of because they believed in me. And so me being able to sell an idea and to make them feel like I could be trusted has been really key. I think the other thing is like succinct structured thought. Like that's another thing that I think a university education really teaches you. Like how do you kind of work your way through any intellectual problem, whatever that might be?
And I guess intellectual problems, but you mentioned the word succinct there. And I think that ties in quite nicely to marketing, because within reason, most people can quite well articulate a problem, a challenge, or a message with unlimited resources. But actually, getting it down to a sentence, getting it down to a word. I listened to, and I won't actually read the piece of marketing because it's pretty heavy, but I remember listening to an interview with, I'm pretty sure it was Richard Branson, talking about that you couldn't tell a story in one sentence, and he reads out a sentence and you go, ah, okay, you can. And I think there is a beauty in that, but also there's something like that you mentioned there around the academic side of things, of getting told, actually, that's great, but I need that in half the amount of words. And then you really start to think about, am I actually getting my message across clearly? And that's something I do work with coaches quite a lot in the sports arena, and actually saying, if you're talking to a younger generation coming through now, they don't want a 15-point presentation on something that can be delivered in a tweet, because that's their language. And I think working and advising and supporting people, teaching that skill to people who it doesn't come naturally to, is a real challenge. So how do you impart that to others who perhaps haven't had that kind of experience that you've had?
I just drill them on, like, what are you really saying? So you're completely right that everyone can kind of fudge through something if they have all the time in the world. I think it's often that volume is a smokescreen for I'm in the right ballpark, but I haven't done the extra 20% to really pin down what this is. And if I kind of put enough fluff around it, you won't notice that I'm not actually accurate on what it is I'm trying to communicate. It's funny you say that. Yesterday I had some feedback on a proposal and someone came back and said, like, can you clarify how long the output deck will be and what will be included in it? And I was like, it's going to be very, very short, because that's why it's good. Like, you know, number of slides here is actually has an inverse correlation with quality of work. You want to pay a lot of money for a few very succinct, well thought through points. And then you need to understand why it's got there, but the output needs to be really tight. So I just do a lot of coaching with my team on, like, what are you actually saying? Explain this to me as though I'm a Martian. Explain this to me as though I've got no context. Explain it to me in a sentence. All of these games to try and pull apart what is wrapper here and what is actually the core argument. And Amazon, I'm obsessed with this. Amazon start their meetings with a one-page document, like a Word document. So you're not allowed to use slides. You have to use full prose, because their thinking is that slides basically just allow you to do, like, waffly storytelling. And if you have to put something in written English, you have to be more, like, exacting in what you're communicating. So I think it's interesting that there's different work environments who are taking different tactics to grapple with the same problem, which is, like, we're all a bit lazy with that final bit of clarity. And that's actually where all the miscommunication comes through.
Do you think
in
some
that
of that
space
though,
that's left?
Do you think those with what you're doing now, that's where the value added comes for me? Because if we're honest, you know, the marketing space is quite noisy, whether it's individuals, giant agencies, whatever it is. And actually the first 90%, you know, within that kind of spectrum are kind of much for a muchness. But when you start to get to the finer, the sharp end, if you like, of the performance spectrum, that real clarity and that ability to really articulate stuff is absolutely incredible. And I'm thinking back to a piece that came out last year with one of one of my classmates that I went to university with, and you may have seen it. It was the Norwich City Football Club video that did the mental health awareness campaign that clocked up, I think it's about 150 million. If you've not seen it, it was absolutely incredible. Yeah. But it actually said everything they needed to say without saying anything. But it hit so well. But the way it was put together, and what I found was really interesting off the back of that, that wasn't selling a product. What they were absolutely crystal clear on is the why and the what they were trying to get across. There was so much clarity there that it almost drove the product without any words. And I think that's really interesting, because I think so many people can get caught up in, well, you need a 25 slide deck, you need this, you need that, and actually go, no, you don't. If you actually look at some of the most successful products and brands and organizations on the planet, their ability to communicate succinctly and in a way that lands with everybody, not just with a tiny audience, but unilaterally with the whole spectrum of people that are going to take it in, I think there's a real skill in that. And I guess that's what sets good to great apart.
Yeah, and you're applying that very specifically in the lens of communication. So making an advert, using a piece of copy. I think it's the same skill set that's actually true about a lot of strategy. So a lot of what I do is work with businesses that have limited resource. Every business has limited resource. So you have limited resource and you're trying to decide how to spend that resource. And that decision actually comes down to real clarity of thought around what you need to achieve. So if you're not succinct in that objective and you say, like, I just need, like, more customers, the chance of that money being wasted is so high, versus if you say, I need more of this kind of customer who currently think that my business is irrelevant for them to realize that my business does exactly the job that they're looking for, then the work that comes off that is so much better targeted. So I think there's a point, I think being succinct is the outcome of being very focused, and being very focused comes from actual strategic rigor. And that's what lets like so much of everyone's work down, in my view.
So obviously there's a process there of finding out what works, what doesn't, having your procedures and your practices in place that you know are successful. How do you blend that, and especially in kind of the digital marketing space with such a quick evolving space, if that makes sense, in the sense that there are new platforms emerging, there are algorithm changes at the drop of a hat, there are all of these things. And again, I guess specifically from a content point of view, but how do you, I guess, balance the trying to get in thorough practice and process blended with the ability to be dynamic, change, and think of different ways of doing things as the market, I guess, changes so quickly? Because some people really struggle with that. Like they just take the single piece of content or a single message, whether it's a sports team, a, you know, a high performing business, whatever it is, and they put that on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, they put the same thing on there with no level of understanding that actually they're all unique. And as I say, you know, the next generation of kids coming through will say to you, have you heard about whatever the next Snapchat is or the next TikTok? And you go, I have no idea what you're talking about. And by which point they're already ahead of you.
Yeah, but the problem there is that there's no succinct strategy. So if you're just putting the same piece of content everywhere, your strategy is put content everywhere. It's a terrible strategy. If your strategy is to nail Twitter, because you know that your customer is there looking for a particular kind of thing, or whatever the reason is that you've decided that's the channel, then you just focus on Twitter. So fundamentally, if you're doing three things badly, you should stop doing all three and do one well. So that's the first thing, is like you're just trying to do too much. Secondly, I think we can get really like, I think we can get a bit navel-gazy and be a bit like, we're in this world of digital marketing and everything's changing so quickly, as though nothing's ever changed before. Like the world has always been changing. And these algorithms are changing to make the experience for the users better. They're not all to try and make the platform make a bit more money. Like those are their two goals. The only reason you change an algorithm is ultimately to make more money. And most of the time you do that by improving the experience for your user. So if you just remain like focused on what do my users want, and therefore really succinct, like really succinct in understanding of what the job that piece of content is trying to do, then you'll make good content. If your strategy is bad and you're just putting content up, your content will be bad.
Okay. No, I really like that, because I know, again, we were chatting before we started recording about what were going to be those golden nuggets and pieces of information. And you know, that right there, I'm sitting listening again. Anyone who works in any field probably has to use some form of social media or marketing content. And right there, they've gone, I've never thought of it like that. And actually, I guess that's the whole
just
point of this show.
Think about the audience. Social media is no different. Like in the Victorian times, you'd put a billboard, you know, you'd go with your PVA glue pot or whatever it was, probably like horse bone, and you'd paste up your poster. That is exactly the same as what we do now. You're just getting eyeballs. And we've suddenly like lost the plot because it's like on the screen, and we've all forgotten that all we're doing is putting stuff in front of people. So if it's bad, if the messaging is bad, and if it's not engaging, that's not going to work on a poster, that's not going to work on a TV ad, that's not going to work, that's just not going to work. So I think we need to stop, you know, most of us are not privileged enough to be in a position where we really need to worry about like massaging an algorithm. Totally get it if your media budget's like, if you're spending 100K a month on Meta ads, you need to know your way around the algorithm for sure. If you're posting organic content or you're spending a couple of hundred pounds a month on this stuff, you only need to worry about being engaging. I think there's stuff up the food chain that we don't need to worry about until we're bigger, that we all spend a lot of energy getting in knots over.
Okay. Well, there's some fantastic bits there that we've already picked up on. There's a few things I want to dive into, and that I guess is for you and your experience so far. Where do you see the spaces that you work in moving forwards in the future? What's your ambition for whether it's growth, whereas it's more engagement, whatever it is, but how do you see your vision in terms of your journey and the communities you work within moving forwards? Certainly over 2024, shall we say?
Yeah. 2024 feels like a good year. It feels like there's momentum again. People are making decisions. last year everything was just stuck in this stasis. So I just feel like there's a year of a bit of risk taking and a bit of energy, and I'm really excited to do some fun work with partners, because last year didn't feel that fun. I think bigger picture, there's kind of two themes that I think are really positive. So one, within the world of marketing, I think we are learning that performance marketing isn't the solution to everything. So over the last decade, we've gone from not being able to measure any marketing to an addiction to Meta, and like every business's marketing model basically being, well, like, I turn on my Facebook ads, I get revenue, the end. And the algorithms have changed, and cost of living and all of that's got harder. And so we're now back in a space where we have to like re-engage brain, and marketeers are struggling with it because they're like, what? I can't use my Meta drug anymore. Like, I don't know how to do this. And we just need to do what the industry's done for aeons before that. So I'm excited by marketing getting back to the understanding of brand building, kind of weaning ourselves off our addiction to PPC and Meta ads, and trying to, like, and the challenge of having to really think again in a holistic sense, irrespective of how small your budgets are. So that's one thing. And then in community building, like, this has been a post-COVID thing, but COVID taught us that community matters. You know, COVID was terrible for most businesses, apart from PPE manufacturers and communities. Like, we were literally the only people that came out of that rosy. And that's because we felt lonely and isolated, and we were disconnected from our local communities. And there was just so much uncertainty that I feel like the Western world kind of woke up, and I really felt it. You know, I'd kind of been this mad woman going on about community before that. And suddenly everyone wanted a piece of what I was doing. And that, I think, is sustained. And I'm really optimistic about that in terms of what it means for society. And, you know, we were chatting before about, like, the quite terrifying stats for what might be happening to swimming pools. You know, like, I think we've lost organized religion, we've lost local community. Like, so much of the way we live is actually completely devoid of community. But I feel really excited by a feeling that there's enough people seeking it out on their own and redefining it on their terms. So yeah, I feel optimistic about a feeling that individuals are trying to reconnect, even if the government isn't helping us.
Okay. You mentioned the word community there, and I was trying to figure out where I was going to weave this in, but how we connected, and ending up on a very remote farm in the middle of Wales with the most eclectic group of people that you probably couldn't pick out of a LinkedIn community anywhere. How did you hear about that? What was your experience of it? And, you know, I know it was a while ago now, but actually you've had time to kind of reflect, absorb, and look forwards. Kind of, what was your experience of the whole Do Lectures scene?
Yeah. I found out about it, I don't know, I just kind of had always known about it. I think I seek things out like this because I'm interested. I'm a bit of a homing pigeon. So I look for community stuff, and I throw my hat in the ring wherever possible. I really crave it. So I applied because I was craving it. I had the most wonderful weekend. I feel quite lucky in that I have lots of things like that in my life. So I'm part of a community of founders. I run a community. I do some kind of well-being retreat stuff, which has a similar energy. So last year I felt very spoiled. Like, I got to do a lot of amazing things, and the Do Lectures was definitely one of them. I definitely, funny aside, I know this about myself. I went to university and I learned that lectures are not for me. And then I was sitting in the back of the Do Lectures going, oh, these are lectures. This is literally what it says on the tin. And I just, you know, I learned that. Our attention spans are just shocking. So I found it quite a ride of a weekend, because there are these like moments of real magic when you're like having a drink in the sun and there's a Welsh choir singing and it's magical. And then these really immersive periods when you're in a day of lectures that are fascinating, but I was actually really struggling to be in the room. You know, it's quite painful to be present. And I found that quite scary about my own brain, actually. So it was a very rich weekend, but with some moments of like, just focus, woman. definitely had to give myself some harsh words.
That's really interesting, because a lot of people, I think, in the modern day and age, you know, everyone has their own views on the best types of CPD and what they do across the year for their own personal development. And I think it's so far removed from what I would call the norm. And whether that's, you know, a wellness retreat, an education retreat, a sports retreat, it doesn't overly matter. I think getting in a space that's a very big step removed from the norm for you is really, really healthy. Yeah. Because like you say, you can get into this point where you're almost on this treadmill of, right, I've got to do this and I've got to do this. And, you know, we might touch on the kind of the mental health space of actually, is that a healthy thing to do? Or actually, is it okay once in a while to press pause and just go somewhere completely different with people you don't know, strike up new conversations and suddenly come away and go, oh, I didn't realize that. Or I didn't know that about myself. Yeah, I've always come back from it feeling learned something about me.
Yeah. It's how I learn. And I'm really comfortable with that. Like, I don't learn from books, really. I do some, like, I'll read two or three things a year that I go really deep on, but I'm knackered. My job's exhausting. Like, I read for other reasons, and I don't learn from online courses unless they're really interactive and I run courses and I really think about how I can move away from that. I know that the way I specifically learn is the number of new interactions I have. And that teaches me a lot about myself. I think it also comes back to what you were saying earlier, actually, around the skills that I'm really trying to develop. It's kind of interesting that maybe I'm doubling down on those skills because I seek out opportunities to practice relationship building and to like test those muscles. Because I really want, you know, I really want to be exceptional at it. And so I know I need to put myself in different rooms. So yeah, for me, it was part of a kind of, I'm always trying to think about how I can get in rooms where I feel uncomfortable and where I might create interactions that are going to stimulate something. And so that was just part of that journey.
So we all do learn in different ways. And in your experience, again, you know, every year we add new things to this list, but what have perhaps been some of the key, either moments, experiences, you know, be that a book, be that a podcast, be that a conversation you've had with someone that had a profound impact on the way that you view perhaps your working life, perhaps your profession, your personal life, but you can pinpoint moments that actually created a shift in your direction.
There are so many. I feel like we're all the sum of a number of experiences we've had that ladder up to who we are and how we interact with the world. I read the Netflix book. I can't remember the name, but
Rules, No Rules.
About how Netflix. Yeah. A few years ago. And that was like a big notch moment professionally in one, fuck, that culture looks horrendous. I do not want to run a business like that. And two, create a structure for your team that is fair, reward them fairly, ask for expectations that are ambitious, you know, like make the playing field level. And that was a big shift for me because, you know, as I said earlier, I started running a business where everyone was kind of doing me a favor. I've been on a real journey to move away from that so that I can raise the bar. That was a really formative book. I had a really formative conversation actually last weekend. I feel like literally once a week I have something that slightly moves my narrative. But I had a conversation with a friend who was talking about optimizing life for sustainability. So, and unfortunately this has nothing to do with like single-use plastic, but like if you look at your diary, is that set up for short-term performance or for sustainability? And I definitely live in a like 7-day performance cycle where it's survival. You know, I look at my life and I think, am I going to get to the end and not have a mental health episode, frankly? Am I going to stay on the right side of that? I don't look at it at my life and think, am I optimizing this for sustainability? Like, and that's had like quite a profound effect this week.
That's quite timely, actually. So one of the early episodes we put out this year was with an international athlete who'd qualified for a junior GB team at the age of 16 and had got thrust into the guest of performance life and had then taken 10 years to transition to a senior team. And they'd had a number of, I guess, accidents, if you like. So things happened to them physically that just kind of derailed them a little bit, but then had a lot of mental health challenges kind of going through the whole uni periods and stuff like that. And when they came back to the pool on the journey back to, I guess, the senior transition, their coach sat them down and said, I don't care if you never race again. That's not the metric we're working towards. I want you to be happy. I want you to be healthy. And if you choose to race again, that's fine. But that's not why I'm helping you. And I really like that, because too often we can almost become geared up purely by our 1 week, 1 month, quarterly KPIs, metrics, whatever it is. And actually having that conversation, as cliche as it sounds, you're going to be working for the next 40 years, and hopefully it's doing something that you really enjoy. Treat it as a marathon, not a sprint. You don't have to get everything fixed today, you know. And I think too often in this very instantaneous world that we're in, you know, click, collect, delivery tomorrow kind of thing, everyone expects stuff to be done instantly. And it's like, just because the world operates like that doesn't mean as humans we've suddenly adapted to that. The only thing that matters is tomorrow. We're still thinking about what happens to us in 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. And I want to be happy and healthy and still enjoying what I do in that time. So I really like that, thinking about that sustainable piece yourself.
It's particularly acute if you run a business, I think, because the expectation is that you're gearing towards an exit. So I get asked a lot, like, what's the end goal? I'm like, what do you mean, what's the end? Like, there's no end goal. I have a job I love. Like, I'm not doing this for a deadline. I have no investors, which means I'm fortunate enough that I don't have to plan towards a deadline. And that's quite unusual. And I'm protecting it really fiercely. Like, I never want to compromise that position. And it just creates a very different mindset. You know, this is the only job I will ever have. Like, I know that. And this business may morph, it might look in different ways, but I'm not going to have a career change. I'm doing a thing I absolutely love. And therefore, this has to work commercially. It has to work from a brand perspective. It has to work for me for a long time. I don't think I'm there yet. Like, I say that as though I'm like living this perfect balanced life. I'm not. I work really unsustainably hard. But I think it's a really interesting guiding principle.
Okay. Now, you're very much part of an incredible community. And, you know, in my own ways, I reach out and try and network as much as possible. As a shout out to anyone else out there, so who's your guiding light, or a number of people that on your journey so far you've gone, oh, they were really helpful, they were useful to connect with on LinkedIn or follow on Instagram or just watch a YouTube video or a TED talk? Are there any people like that that you look up to?
Millie Tamati runs a community called The Generalist World. And I think what she's doing is so interesting. I think she is, firstly, she's just creating the term generalist. And I can say, I'm a marketer. I'm passionate about marketing. I think there's a load of people who don't identify like that and say, I'm not anything. I'm a generalist. And actually, that's the language that really resonates with them. So I think what she's doing to coin the term generalist and to create a real sense of like celebration of that and like a value system for like the Swiss Army knife profile is really cool. And she builds an amazing community that anyone who is hearing this and thinks, yeah, I am a generalist, they should get involved in that.
Okay, fantastic. And then from other people looking to connect with what you're doing, I think there's so many different ways, but obviously I know you're a LinkedIn specialist, so we'll make sure we include...
I'm a LinkedIn fan, yeah. Dottie Unwin on LinkedIn, that's the way to find me. Send me a DM, I love the chat. Great way to meet new people.
Fantastic. And I'm not sure when our paths are going to cross next, but I do think for a lot of people, just staying connected with people and actually going, I'm not sure where this journey is going to go. But I think, you know, that's what I try and do with the podcast is, we were again talking about this before we started recording, is I have no idea where some of these conversations are going to lead. But, you know, I've sat in a room 6 months on, a year on, from some of these conversations with people going, how have I ended up here? And actually it is that little reach out and things like that. So anyone who's listened to this and gone, actually there's some threads that I'd really like to pull on, please can I ask you to reach out and connect with Lottie?
Because yeah, for sure. Amazing. Like the internet's made it possible to do that, and that's so cool that we can do that. We can just like march on up to a stranger on the internet and be like, hey, I want to talk to you about that. So I'm a big fan.
Well, we'll make sure we include the links to everything in the show notes as well, so people can follow up straight away. But Lottie, I'd just like to say thank you so much, because I've really been looking forward to this chat. And it's a lot of people have these ideas of what they want to try and do in their head. And sometimes taking the first step and where to look and where to find a community of support is one of the hardest parts. So I'm really glad we've been able to kind of dive into that today. So thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Lottie there for such an interesting discussion. This desire to make stuff, it was a formative memory we explored in our conversation, and ultimately that's something we can all relate to. That inner drive as a child to do something. But then this ability to build and maintain relationships as well, it is all about human connection and community, and that holds true for so many different fields. Certainly lots for us to take away from that conversation. You can connect with Lottie via the links in the show notes. Upworld is an incredibly vibrant and interactive community to be part of, so please make sure you check that out as well. And again, we've linked that in the show notes. Make sure you hit subscribe however you're joining us today, especially as our next episode will be our 100th episode. Stay tuned, as that will be dropping very soon. I hope you have a great week, and thank you so much again for being part of the Road Monkey podcast community.